Madame Récamier was Lucille Sylphide. It took him years to realize it, but when he did, her spell over him was complete. It is nearly impossible to embody someone's ideal completely, but if you come close enough, if you evoke some of that ideal spirit, you can lead that person into a deep seduction. To effect this regression, you must play the role of the therapist. Get your targets to open up about their past, particularly their former loves, and most particularly, their first love. Pay attention to any expressions of disappointment, how this or that person did not give them what they wanted. Take them to places that evoke their youth. In this regression, you are creating not so much a relationship of dependency and immaturity, but rather the adolescent spirit of a first love. There is a touch of innocence to the relationship. So much of adult life involves compromise, conniving, and a certain toughness. Create the ideal atmosphere by keeping such things out, drawing the other person into a kind of mutual weakness, conjuring a second virginity. There should be a dreamlike quality to the affair, as if the target were reliving that first love, but couldn't quite believe it. Let all of this unfold slowly, each encounter revealing more ideal qualities. The sense of reliving a past pleasure is simply impossible to resist. Number 4. Sometime in the summer of 1614, several members of England's upper nobility, including the Archbishop of Canterbury, met to decide what to do about the Earl of Somerset, the favorite of King James I, who was 48 at the time. After 8 years as the favorite, the young earl had accumulated such power and wealth and so many titles that nothing was left for anyone else. But how to get rid of this powerful man? For the time being, the conspirators had no answer. A few weeks later, the king was inspecting the royal stables when he caught sight of a young man who was new to the court, the 22-year-old George Villiers, a member of the lower nobility. The courtiers who accompanied the king that day watched the king's eyes following Villiers and saw with what interest he asked about this young man. Indeed, everyone had to agree that he was a most handsome youth, with the face of an angel and a charmingly childish manner. When news of the king's interest in Villiers reached the conspirators, they instantly knew they had found what they had been looking for, a young man who could seduce the king and supplant the dreaded favorite. Left to nature, though, the seduction would never happen. They had to help it along. So without telling Villiers of their plan, they befriended him. King James was the son of Mary, Queen of Scots. His childhood had been a nightmare. His father, his mother's favorite, and his own regents had all been murdered. His mother had first been exiled, later executed. When James was young, to escape suspicion, he played the part of a fool. He hated the sight of a sword and could not stand the slightest sign of argument. When his cousin, Queen Elizabeth I, died in 1603, leaving no heir, he became King of England. James surrounded himself with bright, happy young men, and seemed to prefer the company of boys. In 1612, his son, Prince Henry, died. The king was inconsolable. He needed distraction and good cheer, and his favorite, the Earl of Somerset, was no longer so young and attractive. The timing for a seduction was perfect. And so the conspirators went to work on Villiers, under the guise of trying to help him advance within the court. They supplied him with a magnificent wardrobe, jewels, a glittering carriage, the kind of things the king noticed. They worked on his riding, fencing, tennis, dancing, his skills with birds and dogs. He was instructed in the art of conversation, how to flatter, tell a joke, sigh at the right moment. Fortunately, Villiers was easy to work with. He had a naturally buoyant manner, and nothing seemed to bother him. That same year, the conspirators managed to get him appointed the royal cupbearer. Every night, he poured out the king's wine, so that the king could see him up close. After a few weeks, the king was in love. The boy seemed to crave attention and tenderness, exactly what he yearned to offer. How wonderful it would be to mold and educate him, and what a perfect figure he had. The conspirators convinced Villiers to break off his engagement to a young lady. The king was single-minded in his affections and could not stand competition. Soon James wanted to be around Villiers all the time, for he had the qualities the king admired, innocence and a light-hearted spirit. The king appointed Villiers gentleman of the bedchamber, making it possible for them to be alone together. What particularly charmed James was that Villiers never asked for anything, which made it all the more delightful to spoil him. By 1616, Villiers had completely supplanted the former favorite. He was now the Earl of Buckingham and a member of the king's Privy Council. To the conspirators' dismay, however, he quickly accumulated even more privileges than the Earl of Somerset had done. The king would call him sweetheart in public, fix his doublets, comb his hair. James zealously protected his favorite, anxious to preserve the young man's innocence. He tended to the youth's every whim, in effect, became his slave. In fact, the king seemed to regress. Whenever Steenie, his nickname for Villiers, entered the room, he started to act like a child. The two were inseparable until the king's death in 1625. Interpretation. We are most definitely stamped forever by our parents in ways we can never fully understand. But the parents are equally influenced and seduced by the child. They may play the role of the protector, but in the process they absorb the child's spirit and energy, relive a part of their own childhood, and just as the child struggles against sexual feelings toward the parent must repress comparable erotic feelings that lie just beneath the tenderness they feel. The best and most insidious way to seduce people is often to position yourself as the child. Imagining themselves stronger, more in control, they will be lured into your web. They will feel they have nothing to fear. Emphasize your immaturity, your weakness, and you let them indulge in fantasies of protecting and parenting you, a strong desire as people get older. What they do not realize is that you are getting under their skin, insinuating yourself. It is the child who is controlling the adult. Your innocence makes them want to protect you, but it is also sexually charged. Innocence is highly seductive. Some people even long to play the corrupter of innocence. Stir up their latent sexual feelings, and you can lead them astray with the hope of fulfilling a strong yet repressed fantasy, sleeping with the child figure. In your presence, too, they will begin to regress as well, infected by your childish, playful spirit. Most of this came naturally to Villiers, but you will probably have to use some calculation. Fortunately, all of us have strong childish tendencies within us that are easy to access and exaggerate. Make your gestures seem spontaneous and unplanned. Any sexual element of your behavior should seem innocent, unconscious. Like Villiers, don't push for favors. Parents prefer to spoil children who don't ask for things, but invite them in their manner. Seeming non-judgmental and uncritical of those around you will make everything you do seem more natural and naive. Have a happy, cheerful demeanor, but with a playful edge. Emphasize any weaknesses you might have, things you cannot control. Remember, most of us remember our early years fondly, but often, paradoxically, the people with the strongest attachment to those times are the ones who had the most difficult childhoods. Actually, circumstances kept them from getting to be children, so they never really grew up, and they long for the paradise they never got to experience. James I falls into this category. These types are ripe targets for a reverse regression. Reversal. To reverse the strategies of regression, the parties to a seduction would have to remain adults during the process. This is not only rare, it is not very pleasurable. Seduction means realizing certain fantasies. Being a mature and responsible adult is not a fantasy. It is a duty. Furthermore, a person who remains an adult in relation to you is harder to seduce. In all kinds of seduction, political, media, personal, the target must regress. The only danger is that the child, wearying of dependence, turns against the parent and rebels. You must be prepared for this, and unlike a parent, never take it personally. Chapter 18. Stir up the transgressive and taboo. There are always social limits on what one can do. Some of these, the most elemental taboos, go back centuries. Others are more superficial, simply defining polite and acceptable behavior. Making your targets feel that you're leading them past either kind of limit is immensely seductive. People yearn to explore their dark side. Not everything in romantic love is supposed to be tender and soft. Hint that you have a cruel, even sadistic streak. You don't respect age differences, marriage vows, family ties. Once the desire to transgress draws your targets to you, it will be hard for them to stop. Take them further than they imagined. The shared feeling of guilt and complicity will create a powerful bond. The Lost Self. In March of 1812, the 24-year-old George Gordon Byron published the first cantos of his poem, Childe Harold. The poem was filled with familiar Gothic imagery, a dilapidated abbey, debauchery, travels to the mysterious East. But what made it different was that the hero of the poem was also its villain. Harold was a man who led a life of vice, disdaining society's conventions, yet somehow going unpunished. Also, the poem wasn't set in some faraway land, but in present-day England. Childe Harold created an instant stir, becoming the talk of London. The first printing quickly sold out. Within days, a rumor made the rounds. The poem, about a debauched young nobleman, was in fact autobiographical. Now, the cream of society clamored to meet Lord Byron, and many of them left their calling cards at his London residence. Soon he was showing up at their homes. Strangely enough, he exceeded their expectations. He was devilishly handsome, with curling hair and the face of an angel. His black attire set off his pale complexion. He didn't talk much, which made an impression of itself, and when he did, his voice was low and hypnotic, and his tone a little disdainful. He had a limp. He was born with a club foot. So when an orchestra struck up a waltz, the dance craze of 1812, he would stand to the side, a faraway look in his eye. The ladies went wild over Byron. Upon meeting him, Lady Rosebery felt her heart beating so violently, a mix of fear and excitement, that she had to walk away. Women fought to be seated next to him, to win his attention, to be seduced by him. Was it true that he was guilty of a secret sin, like the hero of his poem? Lady Caroline Lamb, wife of William Lamb, son of Lord and Lady Melbourne, was a glittering young woman on the social scene, but deep inside, she was unhappy. As a young girl, she had dreamt of adventure, romance, travel. Now she was expected to play the role of the polite young wife, and it didn't suit her. Lady Caroline was one of the first to read Childe Harold, and something more than its novelty stirred her. When she saw Lord Byron at a dinner party, surrounded by women, she looked at his face, then walked away. That night, she wrote of him in her journal. "Mad, bad, and dangerous to know," she added. "That beautiful, pale face is my fate." The next day, to Lady Caroline's surprise, Lord Byron called on her. Evidently, he had seen her walking away from him, and her shyness had intrigued him. He disliked the aggressive women who were constantly at his heels, as it seemed he disdained everything, including his success. Soon he was visiting Lady Caroline daily. He lingered in her boudoir, played with her children, helped her choose her dress for the day. She pressed him to talk of his life. He described his brutal father, the untimely deaths that seemed to be a family curse, the crumbling abbey he had inherited, his adventures in Turkey and Greece. His life was indeed as Gothic as that of Child Harold. Within days, the two became lovers. Now, though, the tables turned. Lady Caroline pursued Byron with unladylike aggression. She dressed as a page and sneaked into his carriage, wrote him extravagantly emotional letters, flaunted the affair. At last, a chance to play the grand romantic role of her girlhood fantasies. Byron began to turn against her. He already loved to shock. Now he confessed to her the nature of the secret sin he had alluded to in Child Harold, his homosexual affairs during his travels. He made cruel remarks, grew indifferent, but this only seemed to push her further. She sent him the customary lock of hair, but from her pubis. She followed him in the street, made public scenes. Finally, her family sent her abroad to avoid further scandal. After Byron made it clear the affair was over, she descended into a madness that would last several years. In 1813, an old friend of Byron's, James Webster, invited the poet to stay at his country estate. Webster had a young and beautiful wife, Lady Frances, and he knew Byron's reputation as a seducer, but his wife was quiet and chaste. Surely she would resist the temptation of a man such as Byron? To Webster's relief, Byron barely spoke to Frances, who seemed equally uninterested in him. Yet several days into Byron's stay, she contrived to be alone with him in the billiards room, where she asked him a question. How could a woman who liked a man inform him of it when he did not perceive it? Byron scribbled a racy reply on a piece of paper, which made her blush as she read it. Soon thereafter, he invited the couple to stay with him at his infamous abbey. There, the prim and proper Lady Frances saw him drink wine from a human skull. They stayed up late in one of the abbey's secret chambers, reading poetry and kissing. With Byron, it seemed, Lady Frances was only too eager to explore adultery. That same year, Lord Byron's half-sister, Augusta, arrived in London to get away from her husband, who was having money troubles. Byron had not seen Augusta for some time. The two were physically similar. The same face, the same mannerisms. She was Lord Byron as a woman. And his behavior toward her was more than brotherly. He took her to the theater, to dances, received her at home, treating her with an intimate spirit that Augusta soon returned. Indeed, the kind and tender attention that Byron showered on her soon became physical. Augusta was a devoted wife with three children, yet she yielded to her half-brother's advances. How could she help herself? He stirred up a strange passion in her, a stronger passion than she felt for any other man, including her husband. For Byron, his relationship with Augusta was the ultimate and crowning sin of his career. And soon he was writing to his friends, openly confessing it. Indeed, he delighted in their shocked responses, and his long narrative poem, The Bride of Abydos, takes brother-sister incest as its theme. Rumors began to spread of Byron's relations with Augusta, who was now pregnant with his child. Polite society shunned him, but women were more drawn to him than before, and his books were more popular than ever. Annabella Milbank, Lady Caroline Lamb's cousin, had met Byron in those first months of 1812, when he was the toast of London. Annabella was sober and down to earth, and her interests were science and religion, but there was something about Byron that attracted her, and the feeling seemed to be returned. Not only did the two become friends, to her bewilderment, he showed another kind of interest in her, even at one point proposing marriage. This was in the midst of the scandal over Byron and Caroline Lamb, and Annabella did not take the proposal seriously. Over the next few months, she followed his career from a distance and heard the troubling rumors of incest. Yet in 1813 she wrote her aunt, I consider his acquaintance as so desirable that I would incur the risk of being called a flirt for the sake of enjoying it. Reading his new poems, she wrote that his description of love almost makes me in love. She was developing an obsession with Byron, of which word soon reached him. They renewed their friendship, and in 1814 he proposed again. This time she accepted. Byron was a fallen angel, and she would be the one to reform him. It did not turn out that way. Byron had hoped that married life would calm him down, but after the ceremony he realized it was a mistake. He told Annabella, "Now you will find that you have married a devil." Within a few years, the marriage fell apart. In 1816, Byron left England, never to return. He traveled through Italy for a while. Everyone knew his story, the affairs, the incest, the cruelty to his lovers. But wherever he went, Italian women, particularly married noble women, pursued him, making it clear in their own way how prepared they were to be the next Byronic victim. In truth, the women had become the aggressors. As Byron told the poet Shelley, "No one has been more carried off than poor dear me. I've been ravished more often than anyone since the Trojan War." Interpretation. Women of Byron's time were longing to play a different role than society allowed them. They were supposed to be the decent, moralizing force in culture. Only men had outlets for their darker impulses. Underlying the social restrictions on women, perhaps, was a fear of the more amoral and unbridled part of the female psyche. Feeling repressed and restless, women of the time devoured Gothic novels and romances, stories in which women were adventurous and had the same capacity for good and evil as men. Books like these helped to trigger a revolt, with women like Lady Caroline playing out a little of the fantasy life they had had in their girlhood, where it had to some extent been permitted. Byron arrived on the scene at the right time. He became the lightning rod for women's unexpressed desires. With him, they could go beyond the limits society had imposed. For some, the lure was adultery. For others, it was romantic rebellion, or a chance to become irrational and uncivilized. The desire to reform him merely covered up the truth, the desire to be overwhelmed by him. In all cases, it was the lure of the forbidden, which in this case was more than merely a superficial temptation. Once you became involved with Lord Byron, he took you further than you had imagined or wanted, since he recognized no limits. Women did not just fall in love with him. They let him turn their lives upside down, even ruin them. They preferred that fate to the safe confines of marriage. In some ways, the situation of women in the early 19th century has become generalized in the early 21st. The outlets for male bad behavior, war, dirty politics, the institution of mistresses and courtesans, have faded away. Today, not just women, but men are supposed to be eminently civilized and reasonable. And many have a hard time living up to this. As children, we are able to vent the darker side of our characters, a side that all of us have, but under pressure from society, at first in the form of our parents, we slowly repress the naughty, rebellious, perverse streaks in our characters. To get along, we learn to repress our dark sides, which become a kind of lost self, a part of our psyche buried beneath our polite appearance. As adults, we secretly want to recapture that lost self, the more adventurous, less respectful, childhood part of us. We are drawn to those who live out their lost selves as adults, even if it involves some evil or destruction. Like Byron, you can become the lightning rod for such desires. You must learn, however, to keep this potential under control and to use it strategically. As the aura of the forbidden around you is drawing targets into your web, do not overplay your dangerousness, or they will be frightened away. Once you feel them falling under your spell, you have freer rein. If they begin to imitate you, as Lady Caroline imitated Byron, then take it further. Mix in some cruelty. Involve them in sin, crime, taboo activity, whatever it takes. Unleash the lost self within them. The more they act it out, the deeper your hold over them. Going halfway will break the spell and create self-consciousness. Take it as far as you can. Keys to seduction. Society and culture are based on limits. This kind of behavior is acceptable. That is not. The limits are fluid and change with time, but there are always limits. The alternative is anarchy, the lawlessness of nature, which we dread. But we are strange animals. The moment any kind of limit is imposed, physically or psychologically, we are instantly curious. A part of us wants to go beyond that limit, to explore what is forbidden. If, as children, we are told not to go past a certain point in the woods, that is precisely where we want to go. But we grow older and become polite and deferential. More and more boundaries encumber our lives. Do not confuse politeness with happiness, however. It covers up frustration, unwanted compromise. How can we explore the shadow side of our personality without incurring punishment or ostracism? It seeps out in our dreams. We sometimes wake up with a sense of guilt at the murder, incest, adultery, and mayhem that goes on in our dreams until we realize no one needs to know about it but ourselves. But give a person the sense that with you they will have a chance to explore the outer reaches of acceptable polite behavior, that with you they can vent some of their closeted personality, and you create the ingredients for a deep and powerful seduction. You will have to go beyond the point of merely teasing them with an elusive fantasy. The shock and seductive power will come from the reality of what you're offering them. Like Byron, at a certain point, you can even press it further than they may want to go. If they have followed you merely out of curiosity, they may feel some fear and hesitation. But once they are hooked, they'll find you hard to resist, for it's hard to return to a limit once you've transgressed and gone past it. The human cries out for more and doesn't know when to stop. You will determine for them when it is time to stop. The moment people feel that something is prohibited, a part of them will want it. That is what makes a married man or woman such a delicious target. The more someone is prohibited, the greater the desire. George Villiers, the Earl of Buckingham, was the favorite first of King James I, then of James's son, King Charles I. Nothing was ever denied him. In 1625, on a visit to France, he met the beautiful Queen Anne, and fell hopelessly in love. What could be more impossible, more out of reach, than the queen of a rival power? He could have had almost any other woman, but the prohibited nature of the queen completely inflamed him, until he embarrassed himself and his country by trying to kiss her in public. Since what is forbidden is desired, somehow you must make yourself seem forbidden. The most blatant way to do this is to engage in behavior that gives you a dark and forbidden aura. Theoretically, you are someone to avoid. In fact, you are too seductive to resist. That was the allure of the actor Errol Flynn, who, like Byron, often found himself the pursued rather than the pursuer. Flynn was devilishly handsome, but he also had something else, a definite criminal streak. In his wild youth, he engaged in all kinds of shady activities. In the 1950s, he was charged with rape, a permanent stain on his reputation, even though he was acquitted, but his popularity among women only increased. Play up your dark side, and you will have a similar effect. For your targets to be involved with you means going beyond their limits, doing something naughty and unacceptable to society, to their peers. For many, that is reason to bite the bait. In Junichiro Tanizaki's 1928 novel, Quicksand, Sonoko Kakiuchi, The wife of a respectable lawyer is bored and decides to take art classes to while away the time. There, she finds herself fascinated with a fellow female student, the beautiful Mitsuko, who befriends her, then seduces her. Kakiuchi is forced to tell endless lies to her husband about her involvement with Mitsuko and their frequent trysts. Mitsuko slowly involves her in all kinds of nefarious activities, including a love triangle with a bizarre young man. Each time Kakiuchi is made to explore some forbidden pleasure, Mitsuko challenges her to go further and further. Kakiuchi hesitates, feels remorse. She knows she is in the clutches of a devilish young seductress who has played on her boredom to lead her astray. But in the end, she cannot help following Mitsuko's lead. Each transgressive act makes her want more. Once your targets are drawn by the lure of the forbidden, dare them to match you in transgressive behavior. Any kind of challenge is seductive. Take it slowly, heightening the challenge only after they show signs of yielding to you. Once they are under your spell, they may not even notice how far out on a limb you have taken them. The great 18th century rake Duc de Richelieu had a predilection for young girls, and he would often heighten the seduction by enveloping them in transgressive behavior, to which the young are particularly susceptible. For instance, he would find a way into the young girl's house and lure her into her bed. The parents would be just down the hall, adding the proper spice. Sometimes he would act as if they were about to be discovered, the momentary fright sharpening the overall thrill. In all cases, he would try to turn the young girl against her parents, ridiculing their religious zeal or prudery or pious behavior. The Duke's strategy was to attack the values that his targets held dearest, precisely the values that represent a limit. In a young person, family ties, religious ties, and the like are useful to the seducer. Young people barely need a reason to rebel against them. The strategy, though, can be applied to a person of any age. For every deeply held value, there is a shadow side, a doubt, a desire to explore what those values forbid. In Renaissance Italy, a prostitute would dress as a lady and go to church. Nothing was more exciting to a man than to exchange glances with a woman whom he knew to be a whore as he was surrounded by his wife, family, peers, and church officials. Every religion or value system creates a dark side, the shadow realm of everything it prohibits. Tease your targets, get them to flirt with whatever transgresses their family values, which are often emotional yet superficial, since they are imposed from the outside. One of the most seductive men of the 20th century, Rudolph Valentino, was known as the sex menace. His appeal for women was twofold. He could be tender and attentive, but he also hinted of cruelty. At any moment, he could become dangerously bold, perhaps even a little violent. The studios played up this double image as much as possible. When it was reported that he had been abusive to his wife, for example, they exploited the story. A mix of the masculine and the feminine, the violent and the tender, will always seem transgressive and appealing. Love is supposed to be tender and delicate. But in fact, it can release violent and destructive emotions, and the possible violence of love, the way it breaks down our normal reasonableness, is just what attracts us. Approach romance's violent side by mixing a cruel streak into your tender attentions, particularly in the latter stages of the seduction, when the target is in your clutches. The courtesan Lola Montez was known to turn to violence, using a whip now and then. And Lou Andrea Salome could be exceptionally cruel to her men, playing coquettish games, turning alternately icy and demanding. Her cruelty only kept her targets coming back for more. A masochistic involvement can represent a great transgressive release. The more illicit your seduction feels, the more powerful its effect. Give your targets the feeling that they're committing a kind of crime, a deed whose guilt they share with you. Create public moments in which the two of you know something that those around you do not. It could be phrases and looks that only you recognize, a secret. Byron's seductive appeal to Lady Frances was connected to the nearness of her husband. In his company, for example, she had a love letter of Byron's hidden in her bosom. Johannes, the protagonist of Soren Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, sent a message to his target, the young Cordelia, in the middle of a dinner party they were both attending. She could not reveal to the other guests that it was from him, for then she would have to do some explaining. He might also say something in public that would have a special meaning for her, since it referred to something in one of his letters. All of this added spice to the affair by giving it a feeling of a shared secret, even a guilty crime. It's critical to play on tensions like these in public, creating a sense of complicity and collusion against the world. In the Tristan and Isolde legend, the famous lovers reach the heights of bliss and exhilaration exactly because of the taboos they break. Isolde is engaged to King Mark. She will soon be a married woman. Tristan is a loyal subject and warrior in the service of King Mark, who is his father's age. The whole affair has a feeling of stealing away the bride from the father. Epitomizing the concept of love in the Western world, the legend has had immense influence over the ages, and a crucial part of it is the idea that without obstacles, without a feeling of transgression, love is weak and flavorless. People may be straining to remove restrictions on private behavior, to make everything freer in the world today, but that only makes seduction more difficult and less exciting. Do what you can to reintroduce a feeling of transgression and crime, even if it is only psychological or illusory. There must be obstacles to overcome, social norms to flout, laws to break before the seduction can be consummated. It might seem that a permissive society imposes few limits. Find some. There will always be limits, sacred cows, behavioral standards, endless ammunition for stirring up the transgressive and taboo. Reversal. The reversal of stirring up taboos would be to stay within the limits of acceptable behavior. That would make for a very tepid seduction, which is not to say that only evil or wild behavior is seductive. Goodness, kindness, and an aura of spirituality can be tremendously attractive, since they are rare qualities. But notice that the game is the same. A person who is kind or good or spiritual within the limits that society prescribes has a weak appeal. It is those who go to the extreme, the Gandhis, the Krishnamurtis, who seduce us. They don't merely expound a spiritual lifestyle, they do away with all personal material comfort to live out their ascetic ideals. They too go beyond the limits, transgressing acceptable behavior because societies would find it hard to function if everyone went to such lengths. In seduction, there is absolutely no power in respecting boundaries and limits. Chapter 19. Use Spiritual Lures. Everyone has doubts and insecurities about their body, their self-worth, their sexuality. If your seduction appeals exclusively to the physical, you will stir up these doubts and make your targets self-conscious. Instead, lure them out of their insecurities by making them focus on something sublime and spiritual, a religious experience, a lofty work of art, the occult. Play up your divine qualities. Affect an air of discontent with worldly things. Speak of the stars, destiny, the hidden threads that unite you and the object of the seduction. Lost in a spiritual mist, the target will feel light and uninhibited. Deepen the effect of your seduction by making its sexual culmination seem like the spiritual union of two souls. Object of worship. Léon de Pougy was the reigning courtesan of 1890s Paris. Slender and androgynous, she was a novelty, and the wealthiest men in Europe vied to possess her. By late in the decade, however, she had grown tired of it all. "What a sterile life," she wrote a friend. "Always the same routine, the bois, the races, fittings, and to end an insipid day, dinner." What wearied the courtesan most was the constant attention of her male admirers, who sought to monopolize her physical charms. One spring day in 1899, Léon was riding in an open carriage through the Bois de Boulogne. As usual, men tipped their hats at her as she passed by, but one of these admirers caught her by surprise, a young woman with long blonde hair, who gave her an intense, worshipful stare. Léon smiled at the woman, who smiled and bowed in return. A few days later, Léon began to receive cards and flowers from a 23-year-old American named Natalie Barney, who identified herself as the blonde admirer in the Bois de Boulogne, and asked for a rendezvous. Léon invited Natalie to visit, but to amuse herself, she decided to play a little joke. A friend would take her place, lounging on her bed in the dark boudoir, while Léon would hide behind a screen. Natalie arrived at the appointed hour. She wore the costume of a Florentine page and carried a bouquet of flowers. Kneeling before the bed, she began to praise the courtesan, comparing her to a Fra Angelico painting. All too soon, she heard someone laugh, and standing up, she realized the joke that had been played on her. She blushed and made for the door. When Léon hurried out from behind the screen, Natalie chastised her. The courtesan had the face of an angel, but apparently not the spirit. "Contrite," Léon whispered, "come back tomorrow morning. I'll be alone." The young American showed up the next day wearing the same outfit. She was witty and spirited. Léon relaxed in her presence and invited her to stay for the courtesan's morning ritual, the elaborate makeup, clothes, and jewelry she put on before heading out into the world. Watching reverently, Natalie remarked that she worshipped beauty and that Léon was the most beautiful woman she had ever seen. Playing the part of the page, she followed Léon to the carriage, opened the door for her with a bow, and accompanied her on her habitual ride through the Bois de Boulogne. Once inside the park, Natalie knelt on the floor out of sight of the passing gentlemen who tipped their hats to Léon. She recited poems she had written in Léon's honor, and she told the courtesan she considered it a mission to rescue her from the seamy career into which she had fallen. That evening, Natalie took her to the theater to see Sarah Bernhardt play Hamlet. During the intermission, she told Léon that she identified with Hamlet, his hunger for the sublime, his hatred of tyranny, which, for her, was the tyranny of men over women. Over the next few days, Léon received a steady flow of flowers from Natalie and telegrams with little poems in her honor. Slowly, the worshipful words and looks became more physical, with the occasional touch, then a caress, even a kiss, and a kiss that felt different from any in Léon's experience. One morning, with Natalie in attendance, Léon prepared to take a bath. As she slipped out of her nightgown, Natalie suddenly flung herself at her friend's feet, kissing her ankles. The courtesan freed herself and hurried into the bath, only for Natalie to throw off her clothes and join her. Within a few days, all Paris knew that Léon de Pougy had a new lover, Natalie Barney. Léon made no effort to disguise her new affair, publishing a novel, Idylle Saphique, detailing every aspect of Natalie's seduction. She had never had an affair with a woman before, and she described her involvement with Natalie as something like a mystical experience. Even at the end of her long life, she remembered the affair as by far her most intense. Renée Vivien was a young Englishwoman who had come to Paris to write poetry and flee the marriage that her father was trying to arrange for her. Renée was obsessed with death. She also felt there was something wrong with her, experiencing moments of intense self-loathing. In 1900, Renée met Natalie at the theater. Something about the American's kind eyes melted Renée's normal reserve, and she began sending poems to Natalie, who responded with poems of her own. They soon became friends. Renée confessed that she had had an intense friendship with another woman, but that it remained platonic. The thought of physical involvement repulsed her. Natalie told her about the ancient Greek poet Sappho, who celebrated love between women as the only love that is innocent and pure. One night, Renée, inspired by their discussions, invited Natalie to her apartment, which she had transformed into a kind of chapel. The room was filled with candles and with white lilies, the flowers she associated with Natalie. That night, the two women became lovers. They soon moved in together, but when Renée realized that Natalie could not be faithful to her, her love turned into hatred. She broke off the relationship, moved out, and vowed to never see her again. Over the next few months, Natalie sent her letters and poems and showed up at her new home, all to no avail. Renée would have nothing to do with her. One evening at the opera, though, Natalie sat down beside her and gave her a poem she had written in her honor. She expressed her regrets for the past and also a simple request. The two women should go on a pilgrimage to the Greek island of Lesbos, Sappho's home. Only there could they purify themselves and their relationship. Renée could not resist. On the island, they retraced the poetess's steps, imagining they were transported back into the pagan, innocent days of ancient Greece. For Renée, Natalie had become Sappho herself. When they finally returned to Paris, Renée wrote her, "My blonde siren, I don't want you to become like those who dwell on earth. I want you to stay yourself, for this is the way you cast your spell over me." Their affair lasted until Renée's death in 1909. Interpretation. Léon de Pougy and Renée Vivien both suffered a similar oppression. They were self-absorbed, hyper-aware of themselves. The source of this habit in Léon was men's constant attention to her body. She could never escape their looks, which plagued her with a feeling of heaviness. Renée, meanwhile, thought too much about her own problems, her repression of her lesbianism, her mortality. She felt consumed with self-hatred. Natalie Barney, on the other hand, was buoyant, light-hearted, absorbed in the world around her. Her seductions, and by the end of her life they numbered well into the hundreds, all had a similar quality. She took the victim outside herself, directing her attention toward beauty, poetry, the innocence of sapphic love. She invited her women to participate in a kind of cult in which they would worship these sublimities. To heighten the cult-like feeling, she involved them in little rituals. They would call each other by new names, send each other poems in daily telegrams, wear costumes, make pilgrimages to holy sites. Two things would inevitably happen. The women would start to direct some of the worshipful feelings they were experiencing toward Natalie, who seemed as lofty and beautiful as the things she held up to be adored. And pleasantly diverted into this spiritualized realm, they would also lose any heaviness they had felt about their bodies, their selves, their identities. Their repression of their sexuality would melt away. By the time Natalie kissed or caressed them, it would feel like something innocent, pure, as if they had returned to the Garden of Eden before the fall. Religion is the great balm of existence, because it takes us outside ourselves, connects us to something larger. As we contemplate the object of worship, God or nature, our burdens are lifted away. It's wonderful to feel raised up from the earth to experience that kind of lightness. No matter how progressive the times, many of us feel uncomfortable with our bodies, our animal drives. A seducer who focuses too much attention on the physical will stir up self-consciousness and a residue of disgust. So, focus attention on something else. Invite the other person to worship something beautiful in the world. It could be nature, a work of art, even God or gods. Paganism never goes out of fashion. People are dying to believe in something. Add some rituals. If you can make yourself seem to resemble the thing you are worshipping, you are natural, aesthetic, noble, and sublime, your targets will transfer their worship to you. Religion and spirituality are full of sexual undertones that can be brought to the surface once you have made your targets lose their self-awareness. From spiritual ecstasy to sexual ecstasy is but one small step. Keys to seduction. Religion is the most seductive system that mankind has created. Death is our greatest fear, and religion offers us the illusion that we're immortal, that something about us will live on. The idea that we are an infinitesimal part of a vast and indifferent universe is terrifying. Religion humanizes this universe, makes us feel important and loved. We are not animals governed by uncontrollable drives, animals that die for no apparent reason, but creatures made in the image of a supreme being. We too can be sublime, rational, and good. Anything that feeds a desire or a wished-for illusion is seductive, and nothing can match religion in this arena. Pleasure is the bait that you use to lure a person into your web, but no matter how clever a seducer you are, in the back of your target's mind, they are aware of the endgame, the physical conclusion toward which you're heading. You may think your target is unrepressed and hungry for pleasure, but almost all of us are plagued by an underlying unease with our animal nature. Unless you deal with this unease, your seduction, even when successful in the short term, will be superficial and temporary. Instead, like Natalie Barney, try to capture your target's soul to build the foundation of a deep and lasting seduction. Lure the victim deep into your web with spirituality, making physical pleasure seem sublime and transcendent. Spirituality will disguise your manipulations, suggesting that your relationship is timeless and creating a space for ecstasy in the victim's mind. Remember that seduction is a mental process, and nothing is more mentally intoxicating than religion, spirituality, and the occult. In Gustave Flaubert's novel Madame Bovary, Rodolphe Boulanger visits the country doctor Bovary and finds himself interested in the doctor's beautiful wife, Emma. Boulanger, quote, was brutal and shrewd. He was something of a connoisseur. There had been many women in his life, unquote. He senses that Emma is bored. A few weeks later, he manages to run into her at a county fair where he gets her alone. He affects an air of sadness and gloom. Quote, many's the time I've passed the cemetery in the moonlight and asked myself if I wouldn't be better off lying there with the rest, unquote. He mentions his bad reputation. He deserves it, he says, but is it his fault? Quote, do you really not know that there exist souls that are ceaselessly in torment? Unquote. Several times he takes Emma's hand, but she politely withdraws it. He talks of love, the magnetic force that draws two people together. Perhaps it has roots in some earlier existence, some previous incarnation of their souls. Quote, take us, for example. Why should we have met? How did it happen? It can only be that something in our particular inclinations made us come closer and closer across the distance that separated us, the way two rivers flow together. Unquote. He takes her hand again, and this time she lets him hold it. After the fair, he avoids her for a few weeks, then suddenly shows up, claiming that he tried to stay away, but that fate, destiny, has pulled him back. He takes Emma riding. When he finally makes his move in the woods, she seems frightened and rejects his advances. Quote, You must have some mistaken idea, he protests. I have you in my heart like a Madonna on a pedestal. I beseech you, be my friend, my sister, my angel, unquote. Under the spell of his words, she lets him hold her and lead her deeper into the woods, where she succumbs. Rodolphe's strategy is threefold. First, he talks of sadness, melancholy, discontent, talk that makes him seem nobler than other people, as if life's common material pursuits could not satisfy him. Next, he talks of destiny, the magnetic attraction of two souls. This makes his interest in Emma seem not so much a momentary impulse as something timeless, linked to the movement of the stars. Finally, he talks of angels, the elevated and the sublime. By placing everything on the spiritual plane, he distracts Emma from the physical, makes her feel giddy, and packs a seduction that could have taken months into a matter of a few encounters. The references Rodolphe uses might seem cliched by today's standards, but the strategy itself will never grow old. Simply adapt it to the occult fads of the day. Affect a spiritual heir by displaying a discontent with the banalities of life. It's not money or sex or success that moves you. Your drives are never so base. No, something much deeper motivates you. Whatever this is, keep it vague, letting the target imagine your hidden depths. The stars, astrology, fate are always appealing. Create the sense that destiny has brought you and your target together. That will make your seduction feel more natural. In a world where too much is controlled and manufactured, the sense that fate, necessity, or some higher power is guiding your relationship is doubly seductive. If you want to weave religious motifs into your seduction, it's always best to choose some distant, exotic religion with a slightly pagan air. It's easy to move from pagan spirituality to pagan earthiness. Timing counts. Once you've stirred your target souls, move quickly to the physical, making sexuality seem merely an extension of the spiritual vibrations you're experiencing. In other words, employ the spiritual strategy as close to the time for your bold move as possible. The spiritual is not exclusively the religious or the occult. It is anything that will add a sublime, timeless quality to your seduction. In the modern world, culture and art have, in some ways, taken the place of religion. There are two ways to use art in your seduction. First, create it yourself, in the target's honor. Natalie Barney wrote poems and barraged her targets with them. Half of Picasso's appeal to many women was the hope that he would immortalize them in his paintings, for ars longa vita brevis. Art is long, life is short, as they used to say in Rome. Even if your love is a passing fancy, by capturing it in a work of art, you give it a seductive illusion of eternity. The second way to use art is to make it ennoble the affair, giving your seduction an elevated edge. Natalie Barney took her targets to the theater, to the opera, to museums, to places full of history and atmosphere. In such places, your souls can vibrate to the same spiritual wavelength. Of course, you should avoid works of art that are earthy or vulgar, calling attention to your intentions. The play, movie, or book can be contemporary, even a little raw, as long as it contains a noble message and is tied to some just cause. Even a political movement can be spiritually uplifting. Remember to tailor your spiritual lures to the target. If the target is earthy and cynical, paganism or art will be more productive than the occult or religious piety. The Russian mystic Rasputin was revered for his saintliness and his healing powers. Women in particular were fascinated with Rasputin and would visit him in his St. Petersburg apartment for spiritual guidance. He would talk to them of the simple goodness of the Russian peasantry, God's forgiveness, and other lofty matters. But after a few minutes of this, he would inject a comment or two that were of a much different nature. Something about the woman's beauty, her lips that were so inviting, the desires she could inspire in a man. He would talk of different kinds of love, love of God, love between friends, love between a man and a woman, but mix them all up as if they were one. Then, as he returned to discussing spiritual matters, he would suddenly take